Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio.
That's a funny photo of you, Fred. That is really funny.
Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer and Neanderthal man in this picture.
Yeah, Fred. At realscienceradio.com/caveman, there's a photo of Fred in it like a caveman at Red Rocks in Colorado.
It was like a commercial that we did.
Who was that guy with you?
You can even watch a video of it.
Who's that guy with you?
Yeah, that's a hairy-looking guy.
Must be me, yeah. With clubs and bones around our necks. So really fun. We look like cavemen. We did a whole show on Neanderthal, and you brought in a book on the topic.
Yeah, I did. I brought in one of my favorite creation books. It's called Buried Alive, and it's The Startling Truth About Neanderthal Man. And, man, what a great book this was. It's not just a technical book on Neanderthal. There's a lot of great stuff in it. Besides that, I love the stuff about Neanderthal,
but
it opens up like a spy novel. I mean, like James Bond meets Indiana Jones.
Wow. You know,
it was really just interesting and compelling reading about what Dr. Jack Quazzo went through in his travails
to get to these skulls,
Europe,
because it's hard to get your hands on actual fossils.
Very difficult to do that.
And his conclusion was that Neanderthal were humans, of course.
Absolutely.
But interesting enough, we got another book here, The Last Neanderthal, by a famous paleontologist, Ian Tattersall. This is his big Neanderthal
evolutionist
book. Evolutionist. And this is what he says on page 10. He says, Neanderthal, they are their own species. We need to recognize they're not man. They're their own species.
Yeah, oops.
Oops. Enter the genome sequenced. Now, even the evolutionists found out they're human.
Yeah, fully human.
We're Neanderthal. Neanderthal are us. But that means that Dr. Jack Quazzo was 20 years before his time.
Absolutely.
And what an honor to have with us now on Real Science Radio, Dr. Jack Quazzo. Welcome, Doctor, with Fred Williams and Bob Enyart.
Well, thank you very much, Fred and Bob. Good to be on your show tonight.
Wow. It's hard to get your hands on an actual skull, especially hominid fossils. Isn't that true?
Correct. They don't let just anybody in the museums. You have to have special credentials, or you have to be a member of their fraternity, so to speak. It's the anthropologists, paleoanthropologists, meaning old subjects, old fossils. That's a special subject in a university, and there's only so many people to get to see these. I think many professors and college and university graduate school alike never get to see them themselves because they're kept very secretly in museums, locked up, and only a few people get in.
And I know that in your book, I have your book here, you went to the Museum of Man in Paris, in Berlin, Germany, a museum, in Belgium, in Israel, the Israeli Department of Antiquities and Museums in Jerusalem. You managed to get access to these skulls, and you are an orthodontist, and you shipped over to Europe your own x-ray machine so that you could do real research.
Mm-hmm.
So could you tell us, how did you get access to the first skull in Paris?
Well, that was the key to the whole thing. If you don't ever get to see the first one, you never get to see any of them.
Right.
Because nobody trusts you after you have, it's like your first job. If you don't ever have a job, how do you get a job? It's such a conundrum to be in.
Yeah, get your foot in the door.
When I went over there, I had a letter from Dr. Wilton Krogman. Now, Wilton Krogman was a famous paleoanthropologist and called the father of forensic anthropology in the United States and the world. But he had a special honor. He was the one who went over after World War II to identify the remains of Hitler and Eva Braun. So he was called over, and he did that by finding the x-rays of American soldiers, found those x-rays in his dentist's office, who was a female dentist. Then he used the dental x-rays. They were big plates. They weren't small little x-rays. They were large plates, which I saw with Dr. Krogman, and he showed them to me. And he was able to identify these people, and then the Russians stole the remains, and he wasn't going to give the Russians the x-rays, so they had to do. If you ever see the Russian account of the identification of Hitler, it's just strictly a physical anthropological account without x-rays.
Oh,
well,
wow.
Stalin didn't believe that Hitler was dead. He thought he escaped to South America. So he was sort of famous in his day, Dr. Krogman, and I just happened to have him for a professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Dentistry.
Great. He was the father of forensic
anthropology.
Wow, okay. So cool.
and a good friend. Later, after dental school, became a friend after I came out of the Navy, took courses with him, discussed things with him. It's about that time in my life when my wife and I became Christians. Now, I wasn't by any means a creationist, but I became a Christian, and I started to read the Bible and started to see how things could not fit, evolution could not fit into Genesis. There were certain areas sure. where there couldn't be death, there couldn't be sin actually comes before death, so it couldn't come after death, couldn't have blood in the ground, because when God said it was all very good, later on, when Cain murdered Abel, he said that blood in the ground was calling to him, and of course that wasn't very good. Dr. Krogman and I actually discussed these things, even though neither one of us had much knowledge of them.
Wow. Was he a Christian?
Yeah, and it was amazing, and he was open to the idea of studying fossils to try and determine whether Genesis was true. And I basically thought that was a good idea. You know, I thought, well, if you can get me in, I'll go. Well, he wrote a letter to a Dr. Fehrenbach, and she never replied.
So, Dr. Krogman, is he a Christian or evolutionist? Or
well, he became a Christian before he passed away.
Okay.
He was,
but at that time, was he a Christian?
I don't believe he ever became a creationist. But when I showed him my evidence, it was really very, very telling, and it was an example to him that things were there that shouldn't have been.
So at that time, was he a believer when he wrote this letter?
No, he wasn't a believer. I gave him a Good News Bible, believe it or not.
Oh, wow.
Just like a little girl gave to me in my office. Brought me a Good News Bible.
Thank you for doing that for him, Jack. So wonderful. Now, you took his letter of recommendation. Was it sent ahead of you to the museum in Paris?
Yes. Well, didn't get any answer. But in the meantime, went to a dental meeting in Chicago and found that they did have a portable special X-ray machine for use in the field, which is a special kind of a measuring type of X-ray machine, not your usual dental X-ray, but the kind orthodontists use, called a cephalometric, cephalo in Greek meaning head, and metric, of course, meaning measurement. I was okayed. I was permitted to use that X-ray machine wherever I wanted to because he thought the goals were good, the man who owned the machine. And he gave it to me, and we shipped it over to France ahead of us. And then there came into my office a patient, another remarkable coincidence, but some people won't call it a coincidence. It was a patient from France who came in and needed treatment, and the father was on a sabbatical over here doing something for Hoffman LaRoche. And we talked about going there, and he said he had an apartment. But first they looked for us, and they couldn't find one. And then they gave us their apartments. So we had an apartment.
Wow.
We had an X-ray machine.
Wow.
Five kids, husband and wife, a little bit of training in anthropology, not much, basically orthodontics and growth and development of children.
Right.
But actually not a great deal in anthropology, and so we went on faith and arrived in France in 1979, went up to this man's office in the Museum of Man called the Musée de l'Homme in Paris.
Whose office did you go to?
Dr. Coppens, C-O-P-P-E-N-S, Dr. Yves Coppens, and he was the under-director of the museum, not the overall director. He's called the SOUS, S-O-U-S, director. Walked into his office, put the letter on the table, and said, we're here from the United States of America. Of course, it was a big surprise. And here's a letter from Dr. Krogman, my professor. And he pushed it back at me on the desk.
Wow.
Oh, that's it. I'm done. And he said, what do you want to do here? I said, I want to look at the French Neanderthals. Oh, no, he said, that's impossible. You can't do that. So there I was. I was about ready to turn around and leave.
Yeah.
And then I said, it just hit me to mention the fact that he had identified Hitler. And Coppens looked up at me, and something struck a note in his head. And he said, you know, my parents were saved by American GIs. They were taking them away to a concentration camp, even after the invasion of Normandy.
So this is in World War II.
His parents.
So he was Jewish then?
Yes, he was a little boy, Jewish boy.
Okay. Huh.
And his parents were taken out of the house by the Nazis, Gestapo, put in a Jeep or whatever kind of vehicle, and driven away. And there's this little boy standing there, and Americans intercepted the vehicle and brought his parents and rescued his parents and brought them back to him. He says, this is exact words, I have never paid you back what you did for me. And
wow.
So I owe you a favor, you Americans a favor.
And you were just about to leave.
I'm going to let you into my museum, and you can look at the famous Neanderthals.
A chill just went down my spine. And thank you, Lord, for the sacrifice of the GIs who were there in Europe, saving
That's
the
right.
French and saving the British and saving the continent. And they saved this Dr. Coppens' parents.
Right.
So, well, praise the Lord. And so because of that, he repaid the favor And you got
now
access.
You're in.
Wow.
Now once you're in and you take your x-rays and do the things you have to do, then you can start sharing things with other museums. And that's what I did, because I realized that they didn't share that well amongst themselves, especially the kind of x-ray that I took, no one had. And that's what I used to get into the other museums. I shared the x-rays that I started with, and each time I would offer x-rays from one country to the next.
And they realize how big a deal it is that you have these x-rays, because it's rare. Not many people.
That's right. They are. They were very rare, and it was my ticket to get into the other.
You're cool, dude.
Right. So very tremendous way of handling that. So, Jack, what happened then when you got access to the Neanderthal skulls?
Well, I was of the opinion that the Neanderthals, like Dr. Tattersall said, I know Ian from New York, he's a curator over here in New York, what he said about there being a different species, and I know that he believes that. But I was curious because I didn't believe that there was such a thing as a large ape-like creature in between us and the apes that was a big buffoon type of guy that clubbed people over the head and dragged women around by their hair.
You haven't seen that picture on Real Science Radio.
I want to see that.
Hey, Jack, if you go to realscienceradio.com/caveman, you'll see what Fred Williams looks like.
Okay, well, that's what I didn't believe in the beginning. I kind of had my doubts because I started to put more and more faith in God. And I read the order of events in Genesis. Some of the things that didn't quite ring in my mind were the fact that in Genesis, people lived to long ages. And in my office, in my orthodontic office, I saw children developing very, very quickly from the 60s to the 70s. And don't forget, this was 1979, so I'd been in practice at that time around 15 years. And I saw girls especially reaching their first menstrual period earlier and earlier. And I knew this was a trend that seemed to be in the opposite direction of evolution. This wasn't something that was making people better.
Because
this was something that was actually going against the human race, and it was sort of like a de-evolving.
So, Jack, if I understand, that means we would be aging more rapidly,
exactly,
which is not very helpful, and it affects orthodontics, the whole field, because you have to manipulate the teeth and the gums early. What, before puberty or?
Yes, you have to do it either during puberty or before the final menstrual period. That's the end of puberty. And, of course, after that, you're working on an adult. And adult orthodontics is more difficult than children's orthodontics.
Before the first.
We would all like to work on children in their growth period. You can ask any orthodontist that.
Sure. So you have this evidence that people are aging faster.
Yes.
And if I recall, you also were not the first orthodontist in your family, so you had records to look back to.
Yes, I had my father's records from the 50s, x-rays that he had taken, and so we have, specifically, he had dental x-rays, these small periapicals, they're just the teeth themselves, but you could see the roots and the development of the roots was happening faster and faster in the children of the generations I was working on. So that was a sign to me that things were changing, but in the wrong direction. As I said, I looked at the Bible and I saw people who lived long ages, and then I realized that if you lived long, if I say like Shem, 600 years, you don't have a 12-year childhood or 14-year childhood. It's got to be proportional. You have to have something that works out to the same length of proportion of time that you live.
Could that be why, Jack, that in the Bible we see that typically people have their first kids when they're older, like 30 years old and so on, so that their puberty and all lasted much longer than today?
Yes. And then much more delayed.
And
that, of course, was one of the first things I saw when I picked up my first Neanderthal child. I saw baby teeth in the x-rays could last, the x-ray evidence that they could last 30 or 40 years.
Wow.
They had roots on them called torodont molar roots, which were bull-like, very, very strong, and they could go for a duration. We don't see that in our children anymore. We just don't see them. We see them a few in adults, because we do have Neanderthal genes in us, as you were talking about before.
Right.
But we have no more torodont genes in the teeth of our children, and therefore kids lose their teeth in the normal ages, now 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. And occasionally you'll see a retained deciduous or primary tooth.
So the Neanderthal baby or young adult or young child could have kept their teeth a lot longer, is what you're saying.
That's
what
I'm saying.
So maybe the baby teeth start coming out at 25 years of age, 30 years.
They had this protracted eruption phase, right?
Okay.
Long period of time. And you start to see clues like that. Then you look at the face and you say to yourself, now, is this face put together right? And, of course, the teeth have to occlude, meaning that the wear patterns on the teeth have to match. Mm. And so if they don't match, then you don't have the teeth in proper position, and then something is wrong. Right off the bat, you know that, and you don't have to be an anthropologist to know that. An orthodontist is much better prepared to understand how teeth come together, how they occlude, based upon their wear patterns. Mm. And this is what I saw. The very first Neanderthal child that I looked at, the teeth did not match in the way they had it put together. But when I put the jaws together, in fact, the way the tooth wear pattern demanded that they go together, the jaws all of a sudden looked small, and the child looked completely different. He didn't look ape-like anymore, didn't have the jaws protruding, that means pushing forward, and he looked like a modern human, whatever, race child. And he was a normal little guy, so it looked very much like we were the same species.
Now, Jack, the photo on the cover of your book, Buried Alive, shows a Neanderthal skull with the jaw, the bottom jaw, jutting out.
Yes.
Today, this is now 20 years after your work, and your x-rays, you traded them for access to all these world-renowned museums.
Yes.
If you go back a few decades ago, did they tend to position Neanderthal skulls differently than they might do today?
Well, ever since I did my work, they're very careful about what they do, because I talked to Ian and I talked to Gary Sawyer here at the American Museum and New York Natural History Museum, and I think they're the biggest casting museum in the country. Mm-hmm. The other museums buy the casts from them, and they get them directly from the foreign countries. So in America right now, they're more careful. I'm not saying they're right on top of the situation all the time, because there is one now in New York that isn't quite in occlusion, and it does have the jaw jutting forward a little bit. But I have told them about it, and they said they actually can't change it because that's the way that they received it from France.
Yeah, right.
But they know that it's a problem. It's not something that's ignored anymore.
And France had it wrong, and you corrected it. But, Jack, by the way, I grew up going to that museum as a child. I'm from northern New Jersey, Prospect Park, New Jersey, 20 minutes from the George Washington Bridge.
Sure.
What memories I have of, you know, the great dinosaur hall. And
yes,
my love for science began at the youngest age, and it's persisted throughout a half a century.
So that's a magnificent
place. So did
place.
France, when it arrived from France, help me understand this, did they manipulate the jaw to make it look jutting out, or what's the story there?
Depends on who did it. They blame the French on the one that's there now. But back in 1979, I know that the French did it themselves, because they showed the original article that was written previous to 79, the fact that when I got there and put the jaws in correct occlusion, they showed the jaws in protrusion and they look like an ape. There's nothing more ape-like than the jaw I've spoken about many, many times that I saw in Germany, which is Le Moustier. It was 30 millimeters out of the socket.
Wow.
In any dental office, that would be a dislocated jaw and the person would be in tremendous pain.
So they're doing everything they can to turn this Neanderthal into an ape.
Wow.
That's right.
And so,
turn them into an ape and make them exactly like, because they know what it shows.
And
it shows a slow, delayed eruption pattern of the teeth, and it shows a delayed pattern of growth in the face. So, I mean, put two and two together, and what does delay mean? Delay is the opposite of an ape. Now, an ape matures twice as fast as a human. That's an important fact.
Wow.
Double the rate of a human. So, therefore, if you find anything slower than a human, where is that explanation found? Only one place, and that's the Bible.
You know, I think I read in the New Testament, doesn't it say what good thing could come out of Paris? Something. Like that? No, it doesn't say that. So, Jack, was there anything else you saw in the Paris Museum, the Museum of Man, when you held the skulls in your hand? It wasn't only a juvenile skull, right?
No. There were adults there as well, and I also saw one. Well, there was one called Aquina number 5 that used to be on the brown cover of Buried Alive. They changed covers somewhere in midstream, and now it's green. And the skull went from the front cover to the back. And Aquina number 5 had a chin when it was excavated out of the ground. You can see it on the cover of the book. And that was in 1911. I didn't take that picture. That was a picture in a book Dr. Krogman gave me. Again, another one of these coincidences. Now, I had this book sitting in the lab, right on the lab bench, when one of the technicians I believe might have been an anthropologist, over in a corner was sawing the chin off of Laquina number 5 to make it look like an ape.
Wow.
Because apes don't have chins. And I saw it with my own eyes, and so did my son.
Well, that reminds me of that. Was it a Nova show or something?
On Nova with Lucy?
Yeah, Lucy's pelvis. They theorized that it was stepped on, and so they got to fix it.
Right.
There's a bone saw. You see
right.
dust flying.
Yeah, and you
I mean, talking
hear,
about creating the evidence after the fact.
It's evolution after death.
Yeah.
Yes, the evolutionists have no qualms about
rearranging
the data
it, yeah.
to
no.
say, see,
wow.
Lucy walked
no.
upright.
So they carved off the chin of a Neanderthal skull to make it more ape-like. Wow.
That's right. And that's one of the things I learned from Dr. Schaefer. I had been there in 77 over in La Brea with
you
my family.
You mean Francis Schaefer?
Yes.
Wow.
One of the things that Dr. Schaefer emphasized was Proverbs 23:7, as a man thinketh inside or in his heart, so is he. So their thoughts and their presuppositions say to them, this has got to be an ape. It's got to look like an ape, and so therefore they make it look like the ape. Their actions follow their thoughts.
Mm.
And Schaefer really delivered that message to me and in person in his little chapel there up at La Brea. I heard that many times, and I was very impressed with that.
And Francis Schaefer, Jack, helped form my early understanding of a Christian worldview through his writings, How Shall We Then Live,
right.
Back in the 70s.
Sure.
So when you were meeting with him, I was reading about him. So thank you for that. So then what happened? So then you took actual x-rays as an orthodontist, which is way better than an anthropologist would do.
Right.
So then what happened? You had x-rays.
Well, now I had x-rays that were measurable. And they're dangerous because you can see inside the skulls, you can see artificial material that you're not supposed to see, you can see everything, all the measurements that you can't make by just looking at the external surfaces of the skulls like people do when they go in the museums and they see the exhibits. I promised Dr. Copanz that I would hand in a duplicate of each x-ray that I took to him or to the secretary before I left. And I did. I kept that promise, and I handed in an x-ray copy of each one of the poses of the various lateral and anterior-posterior x-rays, or the x-rays of the teeth and so forth. And after that, we had a series of events which most people still question me about whether that was true or not, because they tried, someone tried, some people in the organization that has something to do with the museum tried to get my set of x-rays because they knew that it would had incriminating evidence in them about what they had done to the skulls.
Well, so when you left, you gave them their copy
right.
of the x-rays.
That's right.
You
and
left
that's what
with
gave
yours.
It away because now they have x-rays with the jaws in normal position. And even my son, John, looked at it while I was doing it, and he says, Dad, we're going to be in trouble. I said, we're putting these jaws where they should be. And he said, because he knew the wear patterns. I showed him exactly how they went in, and we put the teeth where they were supposed to be, and they occluded perfectly, but they didn't look the same anymore.
Now we're getting to the Indiana Jones stuff.
Right.
The skulls did not look the same anymore, and he knew we were going to be in trouble.
Wow.
And I knew it, too. But, you know, truth is one of our basic presuppositions, as
sure,
Dr.
Yeah.
Schaefer would say.
So you spent some time with the French authorities trying to get the x-rays back, but to skip to the end of the story, they didn't succeed. You escaped with the loop.
Well, I escaped in the airport one day with the x-rays inside comic books.
Yeah. So you had to go a lot of lengths to make this happen.
Yeah, very exciting.
I encourage people to get the book, you know, for this story and for just the content. I mean, this is a really, to me, groundbreaking stuff because when I give a creation talk, I would say, well, you know, Neanderthals are rickets is what caused them to have kind of a slightly different
That's
jaw.
The old story we
it's
got
the old
from
story.
I think
and
Marvin
so I was wrong
Lubinow.
On that.
Is that from Bones of Contention, Jack Quazzo?
Yes, it is.
And have you talked to Marvin Lubinow about that?
Yeah, I've talked to Marvin, and he agrees with me now.
Oh, cool.
Praise the Lord.
So it's not due to rickets.
No.
No, Marvin understands, and I understand.
Yeah.
And in the book, I mentioned that fact that he had said it, and I thought that might have offended him, so I called him up, and I said, Marvin, I'm sorry if I offended you, and forgive me, but I just had to put it down as if, you know, where the history of this comes from. And
sure.
He didn't hold it against me at all. In fact, we're still good friends.
Oh good.
I'm thrilled to hear that. And so then where did you go from Paris?
Well, from Paris, we came back and started the next part of the campaign, if I can call it that, in the British Museum. And that was a hard rock to crack because they had already, they said, considerably good x-rays of their fossils. And I explained to them that they couldn't measure one of their x-rays. And they said, no, they couldn't. And that's why they let me in there. Christopher Stringer was the head or chief paleontologist there. And he realized that the crossing of the two disciplines, orthodontics and anthropology, is a good thing. It happened in the United States way before I did it with Native American skulls, with a professor of mine at the University of Pennsylvania. I think Dr. Krogman also had done it with skulls from Iran. So I wasn't the first person to do this, but with these evolutionary skulls that are in the line of man, I was the first one to do it for those.
And it's so important, even in our flood studies of the global flood, without cross-disciplinary experts, you cannot understand the consequences of the flood, the mechanisms that went into the flood. So now, Jack, we're nearing the end of our program. Could we ask you, could we do two shows?
Sure, certainly.
Yeah, I got a lot more questions.
Yeah, we're just getting warmed up. This is an exciting story.
So
we'd like to continue with the British Museum and then go on and follow your travels and what you've learned. And we want to get to the genetics because, as we said in the opening, you were 20 years ahead of your time. You concluded that Neanderthal were human, Homo sapiens. Now that their genome is sequenced, that's exactly what the evolutionists themselves have found out. So we'll continue. And by the way, between now and then, maybe you could take a look at Fred on the website, rsr.org/caveman.
I would discourage it.
There's even a YouTube video there of Fred as a caveman. So, all right. Thank you, Jack Quazzo.
Thank you.
What an honor to talk to you. So, Fred, you're right. This book reads like, what did you say, Indiana Jones, huh?
Meets James Bond. I mean, it really is good. I was real excited to hear that we were going to have Dr. Quazzo on the air to talk about not just that whole spy sequence. I mean, it really is interesting. It's really cool. But just this groundbreaking stuff of, you know, Neanderthal is really just people that aged slower. We know that longevities were, you know, much longer in the Bible. Now, people are going to say, well, what about today? We live longer. Well, no, that's because of medicine. Yeah,
we can live to maybe 80. Compared to 100 years ago.
But we're talking about post-flood, right? And we know that people lived to 600-800 years before the flood.
Post-flood, they lived
hundreds of years. We think a lot of these Neanderthals are probably post-flood, right?
Right. They died around pre-flood, maybe the time of Abraham or so.
Yeah, exactly. Pre-flood, it was up to, 800 years. Post-flood, the longevity started winding down, but it's still much higher than it is today.
I can't wait to part two next week, Friday. And our website, realscienceradio.com, please, if you enjoy this show, we need your help to stay on the air. Please click on the store, purchase our materials, or what you can do is make a donation one time or even an automatic monthly donation to keep Real Science Radio online and broadcasting. So until next week, this is Bob Benyart and Fred Williams saying may God bless you.
Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.